Hello, my name is Brad Rao from bradraomusic.com. This is my first podcast here. The topic is Jimi Hendrix. I'm going to be talking about all of the things that I think really make Jimi Hendrix an interesting and important guitar player. And on a more playing level, I'm not necessarily going to cover the discography of Jimi Hendrix, although we are going to be discussing a few albums, and I'm going to be comparing a couple of them. I'm not interested in that if I didn't talk about all the albums. I'm going to talk about the albums that I think interest me, and also the information that I know about. And there's probably a lot of information that I either don't know about or am maybe not particularly interested in that I'm not going to be talking about here. And because of the fact that I'm not interested, I don't know, of course, I can't really tell you. So this is going to be more about his playing style, what he does on guitar. We're going to get in, there's going to be a little bit of music theory. I'm going to talk about a C sharp, 7 sharp, 9 chord. I'm going to be talking about fourths and fifths. I'm going to be talking about pentatonic scale. I'm hoping that you have a general knowledge of at least what these terms mean. If not, maybe, you know, if you're looking more for like a history kind of thing, that this isn't necessarily it. I am going to be talking about history, but again, only dealing with playing. I'm only really interested in historical aspects that affect the music. I'm only interested in equipment things that really affect his music, and like things that like you absolutely cannot go do this unless you do it in a certain way. So I'm not necessarily going to be covering everything. So first of all, the topic of Jimi Hendrix is the greatest guitar player in the world. You hear a lot of people say that. And I also hear a lot of people say that actually he isn't that good. Of course, anybody who knows anything about music at all, the whole apples and oranges, many people going for many different styles. There was a philosopher in the 1800s named Burke, who believed he was interested in criticizing works. No one was really making any serious revolutions at this point, but they were looking at the revolutions of the past, particularly in literature. And his point is that you should value something based on its own merit and not on your own. You want to judge something based on its own qualities that they're intended to do, and not the qualities that they are not intended to do. For example, if you don't like Chinese food, that's fine, but it would be another thing to say that this Chinese restaurant is bad. Inside Chinese restaurants, there are certain restaurants that are maybe better quality or lower quality. But if you don't like Chinese restaurants at all, then and you say both places are bad, obviously you're not really missing the point. The point of it is to make Chinese food. So you want to judge Chinese food based on its own standards compared to other Chinese food, and not necessarily comparing it to Mexican or whatever, or Italian. So we're going to be trying to get into this a little bit. So Jimi Hendrix, looking at it from that perspective, the saying that a guitar player is the best in the world really is irrelevant, and it kind of makes that whole argument of quality irrelevant, and it kind of just destroys the whole aesthetics as a branch of philosophy, and really just saying that it's in the eye of the beholder, which was a very popular view in the 1800s when Burke was around coming up with this idea. I am going to say that I believe Jimi Hendrix is the best electric guitar player in the world. I'm going to make that stand. I'm going to try to defend that argument. I often like to make extreme statements when I teach lessons. I like to say things because when I make a claim like that, I find out a lot about a person. Some of them just believe me. Brad's a great guitar player, of course. I must be missing something. Or other people say, well, there is no such thing as the best. Some people will tell. It gets me an idea of whether or not they want to correct me. But I like to make these stands and to make this argument. And I think the best way to make this video as interesting as possible is try to give you examples on why I think he is the best in the world. And you can judge for yourself whether I think my opinionated statement has any validity to it, or whether I'm completely have no idea what I'm talking about, or somewhere in the middle. So Jimi Hendrix being the greatest guitar player in the world, again, a very subjective statement, but we're going to break down, we're going to look at music for a second, and there's really four elements of music if you actually think about it. There are really, all aspects of music can be put into four separate little containers. I don't think these containers pre-exist, but it's just a thing that we can do. Pitch, rhythm, tone, and dynamics. And really the four things musicians kind of screw around with when they're playing some music. Pitch deals with notes, the name C as opposed to D or E flat. And we also deal with chords. We deal with chord progressions. We deal with harmony. We deal with Shankarian analysis, anything that involves melody or the manipulation of melody, inverting melodies, melodic thinking. Most of music theory, most of Western music theory, I'm going to make another video on music theory later, deals with melody. The second aspect is rhythm. Rhythm is related to the beat. Rhythm is how many beats something takes up. Rhythm is how the notes are placed over the course of time. Tone or timbre refers to the sound quality of the instrument. A saxophone and a flute playing exactly an identical note with the same rhythm would still have another distinct difference, and that would be what we're calling the tone. A flute sounds like a flute and a saxophone sounds like a saxophone. Different guitars have tones. Different pickups have tones. And we look at the elements of tone as a aspect of music manipulation. And then the last one is dynamics. And dynamics, of course, generally refers to change. You hear of different types of dynamics, thermodynamics, quantum dynamics, the dealing with change in science. But really, dynamics, when we're talking about music, is referring to volume, loudness. And there is, for any music engineering people, the volume and the loudness. I'm not going to go into that. But not today. But just generally how loud the music is perceived as being would be considered the volume. And any other real aspects of music could really be categorized in terms of one of those four categories, some of them in a more loose way than others. So if we look first at notes, and we look at the type of notes that Jimi Hendrix was using, most people would say that he uses only the pentatonic scale. Jimi Hendrix isn't that good. He only uses the pentatonic scale. Well, I don't think that that's actually necessarily true. In terms of the scales alone, he does use the pentatonic scale a lot, but he also does some really interesting things with it. One thing I've noticed about Jimi Hendrix is that he typically plays in one position. A lot of Jimi Hendrix's amazing solos, the solo from Machine Gun, for example, is in that 12th fret pentatonic, E minor pentatonic shape that, like, I teach my students when they're, like, on their third lesson. That very simple shape. And I know way more scale shapes than Jimi Hendrix knows. I know there's all different scale systems. I know so many scale. I don't even know all the scale shapes, but I know so many that he doesn't know, and he really doesn't seem to know that many. Or if he does, he doesn't seem to really use them that much. And I think that's an interesting thing because actually his musical ideas are way more vast and varied than what I come up with. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he really is only wrestling with one scale position in the same way that a piano player would really only wrestle with one pattern. They might perhaps use different fingerings to play the pattern, but the set of notes is the same within an octave, and it's this repeating thing. And by doing that, by eliminating a lot of the possibilities that could take place and giving you one set of one parameters to just really master, I think that it allows you to really get right to the music and not get cluttered up with a term that I made up, listening with your eyes. I realize that if Jimi Hendrix is not running all and up and down the neck, I have a lot of students who ask, I want to be able to run up, I have the musical ideas, but I want to be able to run up and down the neck. And I realized, and I am guilty of this too, I'm 100% guilty of this too, so I'm not even pretending like I'm not, is that a lot of people, they're wanting to run up and down the neck, has more to do with listening with your eyes. And if you're listening with your ears, you'd realize that it doesn't necessarily matter if you're going to run up and down the neck in terms of creating musical ideas. Now, any classical guitar player will say that each string and position has a different tone, and classical guitar players worry about that a lot. Although I think that the effects on electric guitar and your ability to control tone through pickups and equipment and pedals really negates that variation to a much smaller degree. I wouldn't say it doesn't exist, but I would say that it is a very, very, very fine difference that is practically irrelevant in terms of most people's ability to perceive music. So it's an interesting thing that he really is sticking in one position and getting the maximum out of. Have you gotten the maximum out of your scale position before you go on? I don't know if you have. I haven't. And I've been doing this for 20 years or more. So I think that there's a lot to be said about that. And Stevie Ray Vaughan is a similar guy. A lot of the blues guys, anyone with the last name King, very very typically will. I have a student named with a little King, Peter King. Watch out for him. And he, you know, but these guys are really playing in one position and not necessarily jumping all around and playing all of the different positions in the way that a lot of people, when they teach the pentatonic today, there's the five pentatonic patterns that a lot of the blues guys really aren't using. I think the sliding pentatonic scales, the box pentatonic scales, as I learned them, the internet doesn't know what a box pentatonic scale is. That although that was the original name that I learned, but the pentatonic scale scape where you're only using your index and ring and you sliding around is really the one that is the primary. There's two of them. That's the primary scale that I think a lot of these rock guys, even into the Eric Clapton realm, are using, and they're not really getting cluttered up by learning all of these other scale positions. In fact, if you know those two pentatonic scale systems and you know how to connect them, you will actually learn all of the other almost all the other patterns, because if you have two patterns and you connect the two patterns, the overlap between the two gives you two more patterns. You're really only missing one pattern, and you hardly had to do nearly as much work, and you can immediately get to the possibilities. So it's more about the possibilities within the patterns. A lot of Jimi Hendrix's licks, he'll play the same note on the same fret. He might play the 12th fret with his ring finger and then the 12th fret on the ring finger on a different string. So one of the things, even though he is using this pattern, there are tendencies where it's much easier to switch fingers when you're switching strings. And Jimmy really eliminates all that stuff by, even though he is using one pattern, he will do awkward jumps. He'll jump from a note to another note that's a little bit uncomfortable and against the grain of the pattern. But I think with him, he has completely freed himself from the grain of that pattern. It sounds like a long time ago in his playing, way earlier on. So that's now the other thing about pitch that I want to talk about too is the mixing of the major and minor pentatonic scale. Now, lots of guys have been mixing the major and minor pentatonic scale together, just so we're on the common ground here. The major scale is 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, and the minor pentatonic scale is 1, flat 3, 4, 5, flat 7, and 8. Those are the, when I say major and minor pentatonic scale, that is what I mean today, just to be clear. And what I found is when a lot of other people approach the combining the major and minor pentatonic scale together, it seems to be really in isolation where they, I remember a great drummer that I used to work with, Mike McGovern, described a jam between me and another guitar player as being soup and salad. He was saying that I was trying to be more of a salad where one bite was tomato and another bite was lettuce and another bite was croutons, where another guitar playing approach was a soup where everything was kind of mixed together. Every bite had a little bit of carrots and a little bit of peas and a little bit of the broth, and you could really get the whole flavor as a united kind of thing. And the approach to the major and minor pentatonic scale in terms of that is really referring to most people do the salad approach where they'll play a lick in major pentatonic, and then they'll play a lick in minor pentatonic, and then they'll go back to major pentatonic. And really, at any moment in time, you could very clearly identify that lick was in major pentatonic, that lick was in minor pentatonic. And on the surface level, that really kind of seems to be all there is. But what I found most interesting about Jimi Hendrix is that he's able to combine them in the quote-unquote soup way, where he will take a... he'll take the minor pentatonic scale and he'll change one, he'll change one note and make it into the note from the major pentatonic scale, or he'll add a note from the major pentatonic scale into the minor pentatonic scale. And there are quite a bit of variations on ways of doing that. And the permutations that you get actually from that is actually even more than the major scale. We're going to get a little bit mathematical for a second. I apologize. The major scale has seven notes. What are all the different possibilities of arranging seven notes? Well, the mathematicians have this thing called 7 factorial, which is a 7 with an exclamation point. 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 times 5 times 6 times 7. Look up factorials if you're confused on this. 7 factorial is the amount of notes that you can do with a major scale, or the amount of chords you can create. That overlooks, and then there's repeating notes and there's rhythm, so there's obviously more possibilities. But just to give us a little rough idea of the possibilities. Now, if you look at the major and the minor pentatonic scale, the pentatonic scale on its own is 5 factorial possibilities. Because there's only 5 notes, there's less possibilities, which actually means that the major scale has 42 times the possibilities of the pentatonic scale. That is because 6 times 7 is 42. And comparing 7 factorial to 5 factorial, the difference, the difference in multiplication, not the subtractive difference, is actually 42. So that's actually a substantial amount. Imagine if you could multiply the amount of music you knew by 42. That's a substantial difference, and especially the more you know, the more that division is going to be important and is going to be significant in your playing, or the more the multiplication. If you have one thing and you multiply it, you have two things, but if you have two things and you multiply it, now you have four, and it continues exponentially like that. Now, if we're comparing the major scale with the major pentatonic and the minor pentatonic, if we combine all of the notes of the major and the minor pentatonic scale together, when we get this super scale, which actually Jimmy really rarely uses, you can actually combine all the notes of major pentatonic and minor pentatonic, you end up with Dorian with a major third, or Mixolydian with a flat 3 is another way of saying that. And that scale has 8 notes in it. So we're actually looking at, when we're mixing the major and the minor pentatonic scale together, we're actually looking at 8 factorial. So this combination of two dualities of the major and minor pentatonic give us actually 8 times the possibilities of what you could get out of the major scale and the modes of the major scale. So this is actually a more elaborate system even than the modes. And a lot of people think that the pentatonic scale on its own, compared to, say, Dorian, we have less possibilities. And if you've added the Dorian notes, you realize that you can really go into all kinds of places. There's really very little you can't do. Where when you're dealing with this major and minor combination, not necessarily saying that every combination will work at every time in the way that Dorian does, because Dorian has no tendency tones, and some of these major and minor pentatonics really create tendency tones and tension, which is the interest of it. But still, we have 8 times the possibility. So we're actually looking at a scale system where instead of the minor pentatonic scale, instead of having a third, we might add the second too, or we might take out the second, or we might take out the third and just put a second in. And so there's really a lot of different new scales. Try playing the minor pentatonic scale, but add the 6. And then take the major pentatonic scale and start adding notes in from minor. You can either take a note out and switch it in, or you can add the note in, or you can add 2 notes. And there's so many possibilities. If you get into the box scale positions of the major and the minor pentatonic scales together, you find that they are interexchanged, and the holes that are created from the two minor pentatonic scales are filled in by the holes that are filled in by the major pentatonic scale, and the holes in the major pentatonic scale fill into the minor pentatonic scale, and you really end up covering the entire neck with only learning two scale shapes, and you have this polarity between major and minor. And I want to talk now about the major and minor polarity, which I think is an important part of blues in general and Jimi Hendrix's style. And this is, I want to go actually into the harmonica for a minute. I picked up a little bit of harmonica, of course, from Adam Gusso. Anyone who learned any harmonica from the internet knows Adam Gusso is the man. Thank you, Adam, if you ever listen to this. I appreciate everything you've done. He taught me about the blue third. The blue third is a note that is in between the major third and the minor third. You unfortunately can't play it on a piano. You could play it on a slide guitar. You could bend the third up. So if you're in the key of C, the major third is E, and the minor third is E flat. And the note, there is some pitch right in between E flat and E. Even orchestra players actually try to find this, believe it or not, without realizing it's called the blue third. But there's something about that. Look at the overtone series if you want to know what it is about that, actually. Where they have this note that is in between happy and sad. And blues is really in between happy and sad. Blues is sort of like you're sad when you play the blues, but you play it to make yourself feel happy. And the whole idea of the blues is this kind of duality, this yin yang, this balance, female male, balancing energy between the happiness and the sadness that is encompassed in the blue third in harmonica, and I think is even more encompassed in this major minor pentatonic duality that Jimi Hendrix creates. These two happy and sad forces fighting against each other, one winning at one point, another winning at another, the mixing the two, you're not even sure which one is which anymore. And it really, it reminds me of life and the duality, the knowledge of good and evil that we all face every day. And the joy and the suffering that we have to deal with, the sweet and the sour. And this, it's really incredible the way that he's able to mix these notes together. Now another thing I want to talk about in terms of notes, I'm still on the notes. We have three other aspects of music to talk about. But in terms of the notes, there's the great jazz guitar player Pat Martino. Was basically complaining about a lot of guitar players today because when they're soloing, they're not soloing over the changes. So that when they're if they were playing by themselves and soloing over a jazz tune, if you were a good jazz musician, the listener would still be able to tell the chord progression. And if you were a not so good jazz musician, according to Pat Martino, you would be noodling around on pentatonic, and no one would really it would work over the song, but no one would really be sure what you're doing, and maybe you're not even sure what you're doing. And I've actually heard a lot of people say that Jimi Hendrix does not have this ability to play changes, and that he is soloing in one key the entire time and is unable to change keys. And I think that is unbelievably incorrect. And if you look at his rhythm guitar playing, it is quite obvious that he's very, very good at changing and moving in between keys and playing lines that really imply chords. And if you've ever looked at a Jimi Hendrix lesson, you've seen the R&B chord thing. Even Steve Vai has a lesson on it where he has this R&B chord style, which is really this kind of, he's sort of soloing, but he's kind of playing a chord too. It's really kind of hard to say whether or not he's a rhythm guitar player or a lead guitar player. Of course, he was in a power trio, so his job is when he's playing lead guitars, he still has to have a rhythmic component to it. And when he's playing rhythm guitar, he has a melodic component to it. And eventually, his rhythm guitar and lead guitar just come together to this sick, twisted thing that is just called guitar. He just plays the guitar and without the classification system. He's not so interested in the separation of elements as much as the inner exchanging and the elements fighting against each other. We saw that in the pentatonic scale duality, the major and minor that he does too. So that is another really interesting thing about his melodic material. So one way to begin to mix your rhythm guitar and lead guitar together in this way where they merge as one is, I suggest when you're playing scales, try to let notes ring. Anytime you're playing a scale, try to hold down some notes from the other strings and have them ring out so that it kind of becomes a little chord kind of thing. Some music theories will say that a chord is three notes and not two notes. And for this case, we're going to have to say that a chord is two notes. Two notes is enough to put a chord into your mind. Louis C.K. we want to be able to say a chord and not have, you know, by playing notes of the scale and holding them out. Now, another thing you can do in the opposite direction when you're playing chords is trying to add little notes into your chords. Add little melodic kind of things. Maybe you add some notes on the high E string on the second fret, and then you add another note on the B string, and you didn't hit that high E string anymore, and creating these little chord ideas, these little melody ideas. So what happens when you start to do that is your chord playing will start to sound more melodic, and your solo playing will sound more like chords. And eventually they do meet in the middle. And you'll see when you get there, if you get there, but that's a little bit of a way to approach that. So I think we talked plenty about his melodic material, his ability to play over changes, his ability to have these beautiful R&B chords, and his soloing, very interesting. We're going to look at his rhythm now too, and I am amazed at the rhythmic things that Jimi Hendrix is doing. And I think this is the really overlooked secret of Jimi Hendrix, and why he stands out so much is because he has the most sophisticated rhythmic, I'm going to call it a rhythmic system, because obviously I'm, you know, here I am, classification man, I'm trying to make sense out of this as best as I can. But the things that he does rhythmically, I've never seen anywhere else, maybe in Herbie Hancock. Herbie Hancock has some pretty unbelievable rhythms. He learned them from Tony Williams, the great jazz drummer who played on a lot of the Miles Davis records. But the stuff that Jimi Hendrix is doing rhythmically, I think, is equal to, if not crazier, than Herbie Hancock's rhythm and out of the jazz things. I think that Herbie Hancock and especially Tony Williams are known specifically for having those crazy, interesting, syncopated rhythms. So let's look at a little bit on what exactly he does. So first of all, Jimi Hendrix goes back and forth between a swing rhythm and a straight rhythm, which ends up going back and forth between eighth note triplets, 16th notes, 16th note triplets. Just that alone, he will switch. He'll play two eighth notes and then go into 16th note, eighth notes, and then go on the regular. So he will move in and out between those in the middle of any line at any point in time from any note in the middle of any measure on any beat to any other beat so smoothly and completely effortlessly. And that itself is a truly astounding way to kind of get started. But it really gets a lot further into this, too. He'll start throwing in fives. He'll divide the beat equally into five parts. He'll divide the beat equally into seven parts, or nine parts, or 11 parts. And I have seen many tab books document this kind of stuff. Now, my reaction is probably what your initial reaction is, which is, well, he's probably just playing random nonsense, and when they tab it out, they're not really sure how to put it in, so it ends up being a five thing just because of the limitations of the notation. But really, Jimmy wasn't thinking that way. However, the more that I listen and the more that I'm looking at these things, it would be amazing if all of these things keep accidentally happening. I really find it hard to believe there's so many instances of him playing a five-note phrase where it would be very unlikely that it was just something that he didn't realize that he did. I think that he would have to know that he was playing a group of five in order for him to be able to pull off half of the things that he was doing. That's a little bit of speculation on my part, but it's educated speculation. And these rhythms with seven. The other reason why I think he's able to divide into five is because actually one of his most common licks is to play five note phrases. He'll play 16th notes, but he'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And he has various lines like that. And when he'll play those lines, he'll switch. He'll go from 16th notes, and in the middle of that line, he'll switch into 16th note triplets. And then he might go into 16th notes again, and then into triplets, and then into eighth notes, all in the middle of a line where he's playing five notes at a time. So these switching between rhythmic components and switching between the amount of notes he's playing in each lick are completely independent, and these weird, bizarre cycles that end up happening where it sounds like when I first heard it sounds like he's playing gibberish, but now that I've played these tricks and messed around with them for a while and tried out at least a limited amount of them, I can hear what he's doing. And he is a sort of a sloppy, I think there's no doubt that he is a sloppy player too, so it's really hard for people to even realize that he's doing this because he's not articulating it in a completely clear way, which really is another kind of way that he is a sort of a covert player. And the interesting thing about the whole fives and the sevens is usually if a musician is capable of these fives and sevens and elevens and ridiculous time signatures, they'll rub it in your face. If you've heard the Mahavishnu or Dream Theater, there's endless bands where they have these complex time signatures and very chaotic, insane rhythms. And they're usually, you know, Les Claypool, they're usually very upfront. I've even seen, you know, Les Claypool has a song called, like, In Seven or something, you know, like, a lot of Tool songs have these crazy rhythms. And they're really, like, in your face about it. They're really, like, this song is in seven, two, three, four, five, six, seven, this is song is, you know, they're really, and Jimi Hendrix has the same rhythmic capacity, but he's much more subtle about it, and he'll throw it in the middle of a song almost as if it was by accident. And I think that he gives it to you just enough where you wonder if that maybe it was an accident. You're not even really sure if he did it on purpose, but yet he keeps having these same unbelievable accidents. I compare Jimi Hendrix to Mr. Bean. Mr. Bean, Rowan Atkinson is the character. Mr. Bean is a clumsy guy. Mr. Bean doesn't have any idea what's going on. He's socially awkward. He doesn't really, you know, he's really quirky. To be able to play that part, you have to be, Rowan Atkinson's ability to act is beyond my imagination. I don't even understand. I will never know enough about acting to even understand how good he even is. So this fool character that is Mr. Bean is actually comes from a very, very sophisticated control of yourself where this awkwardness is almost on purpose. I could also compare this to magicians and magic tricks. There's a big I do a little bit of that, and there's a big trend where a lot of people will just do a trick. For example, I might make a quarter disappear, and I say, hey, look, I'm going to make a quarter disappear, and I make it disappear. And then you say, oh, well, it was in your other hand, or whatever, or I tricked you, or I didn't. But a professional magician, a well-trained magician, will have a more sophisticated approach where they might say, you know what I do? This quarter kind of like represents like the negative thoughts in my head. And you know what I like to do? I like to take them and I'm going to hold it in my hand and I'm going to squeeze it tight and I'm going to make them go away. And in that case, the second one, it becomes no longer about the trick, and it's about the story, and the trick is really there to supplement the story. No one's looking into my hand anymore. In fact, people might even say they agree with that. That is true about negative emotions. Now they're agreeing with the trick, a sense. That's a sort of a misdirection, too, where it becomes away from even the fact that you're looking at that they're tricking you, and they're following the story, and they're enjoying the story. And the trick is a supplement to the story, and not just like, you want to see this trick I can do? Look, I can do a trill. Look, I can do this thing with the whammy bar. And it becomes a part of the story, the rhythmic stuff that he does too, the really advanced rhythmic stuff that he throws in every now and then, just like a magician. If you do the same trick twice, they'll know what it is. Jimi Hendrix very rarely does the same trick twice. First of all, that's because he has so many tricks he doesn't need to. And second of all, because I think it's in good taste. He knows that if you take the coolest thing that you do and do it over and over again in a song, which is a lot of what, you know, this complex time signature stuff, that's what a lot of people are doing. I think that you really lose that story aspect of it too. So there's a lot more about the syncopation that Jimi Hendrix does, but I think I gave you a pretty overview, and I've really never seen any rock musician or even very limited jazz musicians even coming close to being able to pull off these kind of rhythmic things. And if you're looking for that missing link in Jimi Hendrix, I think it probably is within the rhythm. Very few people talk about this, but it's a very distinct and very unique approach to rhythm that I think really characterizes him. So the next element is the tone, Jimi Hendrix's tone. There's a lot of videos on Jimi Hendrix's tone, and I don't even really feel like I need to talk about it, but I'm gonna mention, of course, that he had a very unique tone. He used the Marshall stacks, and he would turn them up to 11, so he was able to control feedback. I have found that in my pursuit to try to play some of the Jimi Hendrix stuff, I found that there were certain sounds that I completely were not able to make until I had a Stratocaster. I had a hollow body guitar I was playing on at the time, and which is sufficient for most things, but there are certain sounds that I completely were not able to make. And once I got the Stratocaster, I realized that a lot of the magic in Jimmy's playing is actually the Stratocaster's ability to just do crazy things. I picked out one that kind of had the crazy things. I have a rosewood neck. So I think that the instrument that he had really opened up a lot of his possibilities. The fact that back then they didn't have the tunings, Jimi Hendrix's guitar would go out of tune a lot. And I also believe that that's a very distinct part of his style. There are stories that he can play while his guitar is out of tune and bend the notes in tune. And if you watch his live DVDs, you can really see, if you look at Spanish Castle Magic from 1969, Berkeley, for example, his guitar is significantly out of tune by the end of that song. Some of the strings are, you know, maybe even a half step or a whole step lower than they should be. But he was still able to finish the song, at least to some degree of accuracy. And that's a pretty interesting kind of thing, too. Of course, he uses various pedals. I found that the fuzz face is the most important pedal. The Octafuzz, which a lot of people are talking about, I found has very little use. And I don't really necessarily recommend the Octafuzz as much. The other question that a lot of people are wondering, if you're into Jimi Hendrix, is how the heck does he hold that note from Machine Gun for a million years? He bends an A, he does a A, bending up a whole step to a B, one like the second highest note on the electric guitar, and it rings out forever. So I ended up trying to get a sustainer pedal for that to help me with that, and that did help a lot too. But I actually found that if you have the fuzz face and you run through the Univibe, that you will get more sustain. And you can almost mimic that sound, too, without necessarily... And I don't have my amps very loud. My amp is a piece of junk. It literally has a sticker on it that says $10. I'm mostly a classical player, so I'm not... You know, I don't have all the fancy equipment for electric guitar. This is just sort of a hobby for me. besides my classical guitar career job that I work very diligently at. So even out of this junky amp, and I got a Fuzz Face and I got a Univibe, and I can get a pretty, almost as long as his. And if I turn my amp up more, I believe that I could get that note to last as long as he does. So I found, without even using necessarily the sustain pedal, and the sustain pedal adds a lot too, but it also takes away a lot of the dynamics. I don't really think that you can get the Jimi Hendrix sound with a sustain pedal. And if you, maybe you want to hold the note and use the sustain pedal for that and then shut it back off. But the subtleties that the compressor crunches really, I think, take away more from the Jimi Hendrix sound than I think anything else. Jimi Hendrix, with his tone, he switches his pickups and he is always adjusting his tone knob constantly. And I think that's a very important part of him, is he's avoiding that monotone sound. His tone is always new. He'll play a line, and he'll play a new line in a different tone. In fact, even in songs in the Band of Gypsies, there are certain sections where he uses the neck pickup and certain sections where he uses the bridge pickup. And that's almost written into the song itself, is his use of specific pickups. One of my two favorite sounds that remind me a lot of Jimi Hendrix is when I use on the Strat, I'll have the switch in between the middle pickup and the neck pickup. So I have those two pickups going, and I'll turn the middle pickup as bassy as it can get, and I'll turn the, I'll turn the neck pickup as bassy as it can get down to one tone, and I'll turn the middle pickup up to 10, which is the brightest tone. And I get this kind of duality again, this kind of high and low mixture together. It sort of sounds like an octave fuzz almost. And then I get a similar sound when I go in between the bridge pickup and the middle pickup, where bridge pickup is as bright as it can get and it doesn't have a tone knob, and I'll mix that in with the middle pickup with the tone all the way down to one. So again, I have this kind of, this unbelievably bright tone and this unbelievably dark tone mixed together, which I think is one of the many, many different tones Jimi Hendrix uses. I don't think that's the only thing, but those are some interesting kind of things. So you should always be listening to your tone and messing around with and redoing that. The idea that you just leave the pickup the whole time, some people even for the whole show, you're really missing out on the variety that Jimi Hendrix was able to do with his tone on his guitar through the pickup switches and the tone knobs. I think that was a really important thing. I have found that a lot of times Jimi Hendrix, when he's performing in live videos, will actually set his guitar volume based on feedback. He'll stand in front of his amp and set the sound of the feedback right, and then he'll end up playing, which gives it an inherent, you know, feedback for him is like the standard, which is a pretty unique approach. I haven't really tried it. I don't really have the equipment to do those kinds of things. Very few people probably do, but that's an interesting kind of thing. And then, of course, the last element is the volume element, which is, of course, how loud or soft something is. And Jimi Hendrix was known to be played as loud as freaking possible, like unbelievably loud. He says that there's a lot of sleeping people in the world, and he's trying to wake them up, sort of, in a way. So the electric church for him is this unbelievably loud, blaring, shocking, surprising, cuts right into your soul, completely overrides the rational process and gets right down into your primitive lower brain and speaks the truth in a way that no rational or poem or anything could really ever touch. And it's direct, and he goes right to it, and he's not messing around. There's not a lot of subtlety. He really just knows how to hit that spot and continue to just have that force ringing out over and over again. Of course, he does have, in other styles, he has a more subtle, elegant approach. I think that's one thing that a lot of people who misunderstand Jimi Hendrix really have only heard probably four or five of his songs, and honestly, they're the same. Foxy Lady is not very different than Purple Haze, which is not very different than Spanos Castle Magic, you know, and there's that sort of Jimi Hendrix sharp nine sound. But there's a lot of other more R&B, Wait Till Tomorrow's beautiful R&B subtleties. Little Wing, and my opinion on Little Wing, I used to originally like Stevie Ray Vaughan's version of Little Wing better, but after I was watching an interview with the producer of Axis Bold and Love, who is still alive, or at least he was last I heard from him from my computer, was that the Little Wing was a short, mellow song. The song itself, if you look at the words of the song, it makes sense that the song is short, and it makes sense that the song is mellow. And this is really where Jimmy opens up his heart into a ballad and avoids that intense Spanish Castle Magic flavor, which happened earlier in the album. And I think that Stevie Ray Vaughan's approach to making it that intense, super intense song, I think is really missing the point. I tend to like the intenseness more, which usually people who like Jimmy does, but I think that it's not to say that we miss out on some of these subtle, these more beautiful ballad-type things that Jimi Hendrix also uses. So he does know how to mellow it out. One thing about his volume, and I guess this goes back to his, this is actually under the category of tone, but a lot of times he will have his volume, he'll set his fuzz face up to 10, and he actually controls his volume knob. You've probably seen the guy talk about that, that British dude talk about it on YouTube, where you can actually roll your volume back to 5, and you can get a kind of a fuzzy tone, which is really good for a rhythm guitar, and then you can turn your volume up and get a pure fuzz tone, which doesn't have as much of an effect on volume as you might think, and you can investigate the science of why that is. Watch, there's plenty of videos that would explain it better than me. So anyway, that is why I think Jimi Hendrix is the best guitar player in the world. Do you agree? Do you not agree? I'm poking at you to see how you react when I say that. But I think that it's, if anything, it's a very, very important and influential guitar player. If you look at what he was doing in his early video from 1965, where they were playing Shotgun, and then 2 years later, Are You Experienced? It's pretty obvious that the music that was happening even 2 years before Are You Experienced was drastically different than what he created. And it's really hard to know the influence of Jimi Hendrix today, because so much of music has been based on what he has brought to our attention, that it's really hard to realize that he is really a pioneer of so many things that we take for granted today. So anyway, I think I've talked long enough. I hope you enjoyed this, and check out my next podcast. Boom.